Are you tired of spending your time and money chasing strategy after strategy, only to discover what worked 10, 5, or even 2 years ago is not working now? Things shift fast in the online space, and if you're not keeping up, you're getting left behind. It's time for something different. Welcome to the Marketing, Media, and Money Podcast, where every single episode will be jam-packed with proven, profitable strategies, behind-the-scenes secrets, and what's working now resources from industry experts and global influencers to help you scale your business, shorten your learning curve, and stand out in a crowded, noisy marketplace. And now, your host, award-winning marketing and media strategist and international speaker, Patty Farmer.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of the Marketing, Media, Money Podcast. I'm your host, Patty Farmer, and I am looking forward to sharing today's industry expert with you. And today is really exciting for me because we're talking about one of my favorite topics, and it's one of my favorite topics of which I have no area of expertise in. So I love when I get to bring on other experts to talk about this topic. So today, we're going to be talking about how to get more bang for your book and business. And I think that's really, really important because I know that coaches, entrepreneurs, and service providers, we consider writing a book to establish our expertise, but we're not always really sure how to get the most out of it. So today we have an expert, and let me tell you a little bit about her. So Tara Almany defies the simple definition. She's a multi-award-winning author, speaker, business consultant, and publisher, as well as a serial entrepreneur. Her boutique publishing company, Emerald Lake Books, specializes in working with positive people to integrate a book into their marketing or sales funnel to attract the right readers and customers. In her spare time, Tara leads a writer's critique group and is a winemaker, a military mom to two young adults, one of each, and is owned by a black cat. I love that because I think it is so true. I mean, I have two dogs and I would pretty much say I'm not sure who rescued who. But it's so great to have you here, Tara. I really am excited about digging into this topic.
Patty, I'm so thankful to be here as well and looking forward to talking with you.
Awesome. So let's kind of get started because I have to tell you, one of the things that I really love that you said is really about how you can work to integrate a book into their marketing or sales funnel, which is so true because I know that 85% of the people that I work with are speakers. Mm-hmm. And in my personal opinion, I think if you're a speaker, you should have a book. I mean, I also think if you have a book, you should be a speaker, right? They kind of are like peanut butter and jelly. I don't really do anything about publishing books. I do publish a magazine. Books is something I refer to somebody else. And, you know, I feel like you are really an expert in this. So I really want to dig deep because I feel like our audience is looking for somebody in this area. So let's kind of talk about that. So I love the topic even, get more bang for your book and business. I think that is really important because I think a lot of times people don't really understand some of the things that a book can do for them. I think I've heard the expression, a book is just a big business card. So many times I wish I had $100 for every time I've actually heard that saying, right? So what would you say? I always like to get rid of myths first, like before we dive into the yeses, this is what you should do. Let's kind of talk about some of the things maybe you should think about don't work as well as you think and dispel some of those myths. So what would you say is the number one myth you would like to dispel about who, what, or why you should publish a book?
So the number one myth, I think, is that most writers think when they finish their book that the hard work is done. And honestly, it's not. There's a lot of work that goes into it because once the book is done, you actually now have a secondary business. You have a book that is a product that you need to think about. How are you going to market it? How are you going to reach your target audience? Who's your ideal client for that book? And so if you're not thinking about those things when you're actually writing the book and producing it, you can have a serious disconnect between the ideal reader that you want to attract and who's actually picking up the book. And so just like when you start a business, you want to think about who's your ideal customer, who can you serve the most, who can you help the most, what problems are they dealing with? You need to think about the same things when you're writing the book. So as a speaker, when we go to a conference and we give a presentation, we think about who's going to be in the audience, right? And we tailor our talks to the audience we're going to speak to. If you don't do that with your book as well, you're not going to be able to use it effectively.
Oh, I really love that, because I think, you know, I'm always telling my clients, and a lot in the trainings that I do, that you always want to think about the end in mind, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times when somebody's being a guest on a podcast or a speaker, like you said, you know, they give this talk, this message that they feel that they have. And then at the end, a lot of times when people think, oh, well, I don't want to sell. For me, I actually believe if you teach somebody something and you don't give them an invitation on what's the next step for me, you're kind of doing them a disservice in actuality. And so I always like to say, think about the end in mind. Does it make sense? And work your way backwards. So I agree with you. I think I hear a lot about people who want to have a, you know, they want a book because they have a message and they don't think about what they're going to do after that. And I believe what you said is 100% accurate. It's like, what is it that you want? What's the goal, your objective for why you wrote that book in the first place? And then thinking about what is that plan going to be before you even start writing the book. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, just like everything else, right? If that's not your area of expertise, that is when you want to hire somebody who can help you, because how heart-wrenching would it be that you really, like, you know, put all your heart and soul into this book and you have this heart to serve and nobody buys the book, which mm-hmm. doesn't mean that your message wasn't good. It's that you just didn't have a plan to put it in the hands of the people who need to read it. And that's service as its best, right?
Yeah, and that's actually something that we've worked into our publishing process, because one of the coaching homework assignments that we do with our authors is we have something called a Dear Reader exercise. And so just before the editor is finished with their final pass of editing, we have the author do this Dear Reader exercise where they write a letter to their ideal reader. And in it, they acknowledge the pain points that the reader is dealing with, who they are, what they're struggling with, why they picked up the book, and why this book is going to provide them with the solution that they're looking for. And then we give that to the editor. And so in that final pass of editing, when the book is all cleaned up and we think it's just about done, we'll actually make sure that there's a connection between what the author is promising that reader in the Dear Reader letter and what the book actually says. Because sometimes there is a true disconnect there still. And now is the time to fix that before you finalize the book and go into production and publishing it.
That could almost be, my marketing hat's on, that could almost be a really good lead-in in the front of the book, a letter to the reader. Because, you know, a lot of times people pick up books, mm-hmm. you know, they flip and they look at them. And if I read that letter and I could hear or read what was in their heart, that might be the thing that would make me just, you know, put that book down or pick that book up and actually walk to the cashier or Amazon or wherever you purchase your books.
We actually often do use it either in the book, either in the introduction towards the end, or in our marketing materials. Because in your marketing materials, now suddenly you've got some of that languaging that's going to appeal to the ideal reader.
That's perfect and brilliant, Tara. Absolutely brilliant. I love it. So I think that part of that really... No, actually, before I start diving in, because once I really dive into those questions, I really want to go. So I'm going to back up one more second and say, we've dispelled that myth. Let me ask you this. What would you say are the top one or two mistakes you see authors make? And why don't you give us an example? Do you only do nonfiction?
No, we do both fiction and nonfiction.
Okay. So why don't you give us an example of one of each? So fiction and nonfiction, of a mistake that you see people make repeatedly.
Mm-hmm. All right. So a mistake that I see authors, whether they're nonfiction or fiction, make is sometimes they will try and go it alone because they don't have the budget to hire the experts to help them. And the problem is that you either have to have an investment of time or of money. You need to spend the time to learn what the standards are, to learn what a well-designed book looks like. Just because your next-door neighbor's nephew is a graphic designer doesn't mean he's a cover designer. You know, there's a difference between the two. And so you need to really think about, if you're using this to build your business or brand, what's the first impression you want potential new clients to have of your business and brand? And if it's not quite up to par, that's going to create a disconnect between you because it doesn't give the best impression. So that's, cover design is going to appeal, be more of an issue with the nonfiction. When it comes to fiction authors think that, You know, they've got this great novel. It's the only novel they've written. They want to work on others, but they want to publish the first novel first in order to make money to be able to support themselves while they're working on their next novel. When it comes to fiction, because you don't have as many other things that you can sell as a result of the book, you don't have coaching services, you don't have other things that you can offer, you're really relying purely on book sales. And many books, over the lifespan of the book for a first-time author, will only sell about 250 copies. You're not going to make a living selling 250 copies of a book. So you have to think about what your plan is as a whole if you're going to work on fiction stories, because the money actually comes when you have more like 15 or 20 books in your catalog that you're selling, because each one is making, you know, $100 a month or something like that. And so you need to really think about the long game. How many books do you have in you? If you want to become a professional writer and focus on fiction, you really need to have more than one story that you're trying to get out there.
That makes a lot of sense. Would you say that when you're thinking about marketing your book and what you're going to do with the book after, would you say that thinking about whether or not you want to be a New York Times bestseller versus being an Amazon bestseller? I mean, those two things are about as far apart as I can spread my arms. Plus, right? Like, those are not the same things. They're not the same strategies. I see them over and over in my inbox all the time. And when I talk to other experts, and I think a lot of times people really don't get it. So can you tell us really kind of what the difference is between those two, besides money, and for them, right? Really what they should be thinking about when they're making that decision.
Sure. And actually, that's one of my biggest pet peeves, because a lot of people will come across and say, I'm a best-selling author. And when you ask where, you know, it's on Amazon. Amazon, you can fully game the system. All right. So what ends up happening is when Amazon calculates the sales rank of any product, but we're talking about a book, they'll look at a category that it's in, and they'll look at it in relation to other books in that category. And they'll say, in this 1 hour, how did your book sell in relation to the other books in the category? And so if in that 1 hour span, you happen to sell 5 copies and the other closest title sold 2, then you're going to have a best-selling book. But 5 copies is not the kind of thing that makes one think, oh, I'm a best-selling author. The other thing is, you know, it's a system that you can game, because you can actually choose the categories you want to put your book on. And you can look at what the number one seller is now. And there are calculators out there that'll help you figure out how many books they're probably selling in a day. And so as long as you can plan and figure out how you're going to sell that many books in that day, you can probably become an Amazon bestseller. Now, the other thing is that Amazon also has this flag that is a number one new release. And a lot of people, when they release their book and they see, oh, I got a number, you have the little orange flag that says number one new release, they think, oh, I'm a bestseller. That's not even a bestseller flag. That is a flag that says that of the books that just released, yours is selling better than the other books that just released. And so a lot of people are claiming to be an Amazon bestseller when they haven't even made it to the top of any of their categories. So there's just a lot of misinformation going on around Amazon bestsellers. And to me, there's not a lot of value to that. When you're talking about a Wall Street Journal or a New York Times or a USA Today bestseller, that's a totally different thing, because Amazon is only looking at Amazon sales. The others are looking at, first of all, instead of an hour, they're looking at sales across the span of a week. And they're looking at multiple sales points. And so they want to see sales take place in retailers, on barnesandnoble.com, even on amazon.com. And so all of this gets reported into a database called Nielsen BookScan. And that tracks where the sales are taking place. And so as a result, to be a bestseller in any of those categories, yes, it's in relation to the other titles that are currently selling, but it's also a much longer period of time and it's at more places. And so there's more validity to that. But oftentimes the marketing efforts that go into making that happen in terms of advertising and all of the different things that you want to do to create visibility for the book, that can take, you know, $100,000 budget to make a book a bestseller that way. For us, one of the things we will focus on with our authors more, because most of our authors don't have $100,000 budget to become one of those other bestsellers, is we focus on juried book awards, because becoming an award-winning author has a certain amount of cliche, cachet to it, as opposed to, you know, just becoming a best-selling author, where it's really becoming very nebulous as to how you did that.
Well, that was really a great answer. And, you know, I noticed that a lot of times I've been seeing it for a while, but I'm really seeing it even more now, is really a lot of the New York Times ones where they'll give away the hardcover for free, mm-hmm. right? You just have to pay shipping. And I've probably been asked, I don't know how many times, how can they afford to do that? And I'm like, well, what people don't really realize is even part of that shipping, because of the way they have fulfillment, they're actually getting part of that shipping as well. Sure. So there are some things there that are probably behind the scenes that people don't really realize how that is done as well. So I think that there are a lot of ways these things can happen. And that's why I feel that you really need to know that it's not just getting your story out. It really is knowing what is it that you want to happen? Where do you want it to show up? What is your goal and what is your objection? And just like anything else that we do in business, if it's not your area of expertise, and I would say that 99% of the people who write a book really don't know how to market their book too. That's not their area, right? Really, that is where they should hire someone. I mean, why would you take as much time and just what you would have to go through to write a book, like emotionally even, mm-hmm. and then not hire somebody to help you get the results of why you're actually doing it in the first place? It's like any type of marketing or media or branding, or if you want to do it well and you want a result, you need to hire someone who can help you to get that result. So I have to say that I think that is really interesting, but I have to tell you, I really want to delve into some of these things that we are going to talk about. And one of the things I really want to talk about is aligning your ideal reader with your ideal customer, because mm-hmm. I think that is really, truly important.
Yeah, I think a lot of us, when we decide that we're going to write a book, we're thinking about the knowledge we have to share and the solution that we have to offer. And because we're not talking to somebody directly across the table from us, it's easy to forget that there is somebody who is receiving this information. And you want to make sure that when you're communicating, that you're communicating with that person, not just about your solution. And so that means having to kind of establish that rapport with them in terms of understanding what they're struggling with, understanding why they were interested in your book in the first place, you know, because all of us want to sell to people that we don't know. You only have so many friends and family. And if you want to sell more than the 250 copies that most first-time authors sell, you have to sell to people you don't know. So how are you going to do that? You have to do that by establishing that you know what they're struggling with. And the fun thing is, when it comes to books, though, sometimes your ideal client or customer, the one buying the book, may be different than your ideal reader. And so sometimes you have to think through that process too, because your children's books authors, they're not going to be bought by children. They're going to be bought by parents, by teachers, by grandparents. So as you're building out the book and what you're going to include in the book, you want to think about what would make it compelling for them to buy it for the child they love.
So I love that so much, because I am always telling people all the time, it's like, you know, if I hear so many times I'm here, oh, it's really important to nailing your target market. And I'm in marketing, right? So for me, it's like, yeah, that's important. But the next step is identifying who your ideal buyers are, mm-hmm. right? Because that's, I mean, really, that's so important. It's even like in the speaker space, I have to tell you, I don't know how many times when I do events that some of my friends, you know, like meaning speaker friends or business friends, have said, oh, Patty, I'd really love to support you. Would you like me to come and attend your event? You know, so you have, you know, another butt in the seat, right? And it's always really kind of funny to me when I hear that, because I realize that, again, they're speakers, right? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily marketers. And so for me, I'm like, I don't want another button seat. I want a buyer in seat. That seat is so important to me. So while I appreciate the support, I would rather your support be promoting the event to people who would be my ideal buyers rather than putting your butt in the seats, because butts in seats is not what we're looking for. Buyers in seats, which is kind of the same thing with a book, right? You know, you're not just looking for somebody who's like, oh yeah, that's a great book. Really, who is the buyer of that book? And I think that is really important and probably something I don't think people spend as much time on, or identifying how that solution identifies the pain points of that end user. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So, you know, one of the things we were talking about early on with this identifying the ideal buyer, oftentimes when you're talking about fiction, that's where the buyer is going to be different than the reader. When you're talking about nonfiction, most of the time, that's something that the buyer and the reader are going to be the same person. So having that clear understanding of what intrigued them about your book in the first place, you know, hopefully the cover captured their attention. They picked it up. They liked the title. They turned it over. They read the book description on the back. What in that back cover blurb stood out to them? Why is it that they're reading this? And what are they trying to solve in even picking up a book like this? And so those are the things that you want to be looking at to be able to make sure that when you're writing the book, you're addressing all of those issues that they wanted, which is where that dear reader comes so handy for us, because now we have from the author's mindset, you know, who this was written for, and we can make sure that those pain points are addressed in the book.
One of the things that I'm finding really interesting, and actually I'm really attracted to it, it really works for me, is I've been seeing a lot of business authors writing books that make the points they want to make within a fictional story. So yes, they have a character in the story, but when you kind of get involved with the character, and then it's actually teaching you something. We've seen that done in fiction for a long time, but I'm really seeing it more now in nonfiction. I personally like it, mm-hmm. you know, for myself. I personally like it, but I am seeing it a lot more than I used to. What do you think is the turn of that, because it's be more successful or what? Because I know that I do hear business people say all the time, oh, I don't always have time to read a book. I skim a book. I read 2 to 3 books a week. So I like it. It's kind of gives me both. So what do you think about that?
I think it's great. I think it's something that has been done for a long time. I mean, you go back to One Minute Manager, which came back in, I believe, the 80s, you know, and that's that parable of somebody trying to figure out, you know, how to become a good manager. So it's something that's been used for a long time. But yeah, there's been more recent ones like The Decision Maker that I read a couple of years ago. And another one that's Brendan Burchard did recently called The Golden Ticket that I really enjoyed.
That was fabulous.
Yes, I love it. I've given it away and all sorts of things. But, you know, I think what happens is we as business people spend so much time focusing on business things that we can't really turn our mind off to how we're doing business. But we need that relaxation factor that comes from reading what is a fictionalized story. And so we can either enjoy it for the story itself or pick out the different lessons that are in it. And there are lessons we're picking out whether we're making the attempt to do so or not. But I think it's just that, you know, downtime that we all need. And for some of us who are entrepreneurs, that's hard to find. So we may not pick up a complete and total fluff book in our relaxation time, but we want something that's going to allow us to decompress.
Those are the type of books I like to take when I'm traveling. Mm-hmm. You know, when I'm traveling for business and I spend a lot of time on a plane, or I used to, I like those kind of books because I feel like I'm still kind of in work mode, but I am having that downtime too. And so I really like that. That's important to me. What's your take on, they've been around for a long time, what's your take on collaboration books? Now, before you give me your answer, I am in full disclosure going to say I have done 5 of them. And I had a reason why I did each one, mostly because collaboration is how I built my business. Every one of them, I've done them from having a publisher do them, hybrid models, you know, where it was self-published. So I've seen all the different models and stuff, and I'll refrain from giving my opinion on each one of those. But I really care more about your opinion since you are the expert. You know, is it something that people should think about doing if they haven't written their own book, their solo book? Because I'm going to tell you, Tara, one of the things recently somebody said to me, and I was like, what? It was, I was pitching to be on something, and they had asked if I was an author. And I said, yes. And I gave them the links to my 5 books. And they actually came back and told me they were looking for somebody that had written their own book. And I was thinking, not to say I'm so wonderful, but I just couldn't believe that they really were like, didn't see the value because they were very focused on that, which just meant that that's what they were looking for specifically. And I am in the middle of writing 2 books, solo books. It was just so much easier to do collaboration books. But is it still a good option? Should you do more of them? And how does, and I know I'm going into my next question already, but I kind of want to frame it for you. is I've been asked a lot about on your, say, your Amazon page, your Amazon author page, you know, can you put those on there too? What's the value of that? So I know it's kind of a big area, but I really would love to know what you think. And I get asked it a lot, so I know my audience is thinking about it as well.
Sure. And, you know, I've participated in a couple of those as well. And it's the same thing. It's initially, if you have no books and you want to be able to claim to be an author, it's the shortest way to get there. And so it is a stepping stone to being able to claim the title of being an author. But remember, I mentioned before that when you write a book, you've actually started a secondary business. Would you ever go into business with a bunch of people you've never met and, you know, try and promote each other when you don't know what they do? And when you're doing a collaboration book, your piece may be excellent in it, but unless you're the one publishing the compilation book, you don't have any say in all of the other pieces that are in there. And so you don't know when a reader reads the book, maybe they loved your piece, but a lot of the others weren't all that good or whatever the issue is. And now your book has a rating of, you know, 3 stars as opposed to the 5 stars that your book alone would have because of the quality that you would put into it. So you have to think about the fact that you're giving some of your brand expertise to others in an area that you have no control over. It's a great way to get started in terms of being able to claim the title of author, but it's not where I would stop. If you truly
that makes a lot of sense.
An author to build a brand in a business, you want to be in control of what that brand looks like.
Now, I know for me and the ones that I've been in, I was always really careful about who the other people were. And I wouldn't, to be totally honest, probably because I'm in marketing, but I wanted to, who are the other people? And I wanted to check them out first. So I did do that. The second thing I actually noticed that I did get burned once and then learned, and I haven't got burned again because I'm really careful about that, is I didn't understand in the beginning that at Amazon, only so many of the authors can be listed, because I was in one book where it was like 26 experts were going to talk about this, this, and this. Well, there weren't 26 fields on Amazon to be able to put that many authors in.
Right. But you can also email Amazon and ask them to put in the remaining ones. So I have a book that I co-authored that had 22 authors, and it wasn't a compilation. It was done as a single book that we all contributed to. But in order to get everybody's name on there as a co-author, we did have to contact Amazon and ask to have the others added.
I just remember that happening. And then the other thing that I remember, these are like the feedback I remember getting, is that as a speaker at my back of the room, right? At my back of the room table, whatever the thing was that I was talking about, but then I always had my books too. And I can't even tell you how many times somebody would pick up a book, one of my books, and on the front, it would say compiled by, and that wasn't my name. And they're like, well, how come your name isn't on it? Yeah. So after that first book, my rule after that was, okay, I understand why my name isn't on the front, but it needs to be on the back cover so that somewhere in there I can, you know, I can show somebody that absolutely yes. And I remember not feeling good when they asked me that question. And I thought, oh, that's never going to happen to me again. That was many years ago. But I do remember that these different things happened and what I thought about. And I get asked this a lot from not just clients, but just from people who know I'm in marketing, and they ask, oh, Patty, I got this opportunity. What do you think of that or this? And they ask that. So I really love being able to ask you that question, because I think that people don't know. So if somebody was, quote unquote, since we're not talking about anybody's specific book, we can generalize a little bit here. If somebody was offered an opportunity to be in one of those books, what are a few questions they should ask either them or themselves in deciding whether it's a good opportunity for them?
Well, I think asking themselves are, you know, who else is going to understand how this book fits into promoting their business and brand? You know, is it going to do that for them? Are they going to be able to write in such a way that they can showcase their knowledge and information and draw business in? Because if it's simply that you're going to get to write 1,500 words and not really mention your business, I don't see how that's going to help you very much. The things you want to ask the publisher is, you know, who else is going to be in it? How many authors you're planning on in all? One of the things that a lot of compilation authors are surprised by is royalties. You know, will they be receiving any royalties? Some of the companies that do this, they don't pay the author royalties because all of the proceeds go to a nonprofit of some kind. And that's fine. But you want to make sure that if you do that, then that you're making it clear on your website or whatever else that you are a supporter of whatever this nonprofit is, because all of your royalties, your portion of the sales is being donated someplace. So you want to kind of think through these different things to make sure that if they don't directly benefit you, that you can find a way to be able to use them to benefit you.
That makes a lot of sense. I know when I've had conversations when people have come to me to ask me to be in another one. Yeah, I've been asked so many times. And it's not that I don't believe in it. I mean, I've done five, right? Mm-hmm. But one of the questions that I always ask from a marketing point of view, I'm adding this, is I always want to know after they ask me all the questions that they ask me, this is always my number one question, is what's the marketing plan? Mm-hmm. Or am I the marketing plan? Right? Is yes. the marketing plan that all the people that are writing for the book that we're promoting it and that's the marketing plan? Or do you actually have a marketing plan? Mm-hmm. Because just like with summits or, you know, tell us that, you know, all of the different things that are out there, there needs to be a plan on how it's going to be marketing. And you don't just place your content and intellectual property and just hope that other people that are part of that, that may or may not be, like you said, their audience may not be your ideal audience. Where is your information going? And do you have a marketing plan for that? Now, if there's reasons why to do it, there's totally reasons, but then you need to have a marketing plan. And so you need to go into it knowing like, oh, I know this may not fit all those check marks, but I have a plan mm-hmm. of how it's going to fit. And then it can kind of work. But wouldn't you say that knowing whether or not they have a marketing plan should be a big question?
I think it should be a big question. I think too, part of that big question should be how long will the book be in print? Because sometimes the marketing plan is that it's an annual edition. And what they do is they replace, when the next year comes out, they replace the earlier edition with the new one so that they can roll the reviews over to the new one. And as a result, now your edition is no longer in print. So you want to think about the lifespan of the book as well. Because like I said, that marketing plan may be that this is an annual book we do. And so your investment of your intellectual property in terms of the content you provide, as well as whatever you may pay if you pay to participate, you know, may only be good for a year.
But that's really interesting. I do remember that in the first few that I did, they said that I couldn't use my content for a year, meaning mm-hmm. pretty much what they meant was I could take my chapter and make it into an ebook for mm-hmm. a year because they wanted to promote it within the book. And I was okay with that. But I was glad that I knew that, but I didn't really understand it in the beginning, but then I did. So I think these are really important things. So thank you so much for answering those questions, because I know those are the questions that I get from my audience. So I'm really glad that you were able to do that. So let's talk about how can you add business building elements to your book?
All right. So one of the other myths that I should have mentioned earlier is, especially when we have information that we deal in, is how much information to give away. And a lot of people, they may be coaches, they may be speakers, and they're concerned about sharing all of their information. Because they're thinking, if I share all my information, then you know nobody's going to need to work with me because they know my process. In actuality, what we do is we highly recommend sharing the process so that if this individual wants to do it on their own, they can. The thing is that there are plenty of individuals who are not going to be able to take your process and apply it to their unique situation. And they're the ones that you have the opportunity now to have fully informed, knowing what to anticipate, they're warm leads for you. So in one of my books, Publish with Purpose, where we talk about the methodology we use in our goal-oriented framework for publishing books, I talk through the Dear Reader letter. And I talk through, you know, sharing it with somebody, whether it's a coach, a business partner, or a friend who knows your business well, and getting feedback on it. And oh, by the way, if you don't have somebody to do that with, we have a package that we can do that with you and provide our knowledge and insight and expertise. So adding in these kind of things that allow in a very soft pitch way, you to remind people that you have, that this is what you do, this is what you have to offer, is a great way of adding in a business building element. There's always the things that you'll see at the end in terms of putting in the bio that if you need a speaker, you know, you can do that. But we also will recommend putting in specific downloadable resources. So checklists, templates, things like that. So if you want, you know, you've talked through this whole long thing. Somebody doesn't need to necessarily read the whole book again to understand what it is you have in mind. They just need a quick reference sheet. Well, you can create a downloadable reference sheet that you have to go to an opt-in page in order to get, and that builds your mailing list, which allows you then to continue to think through and build that relationship with them, because they may not be ready to work with you now, but as you continue to educate them and train them and connect with them through your newsletter and your mailings, eventually they may become an ideal client for you.
Wow, that was really good. So now let's talk a little bit about the book funnel. What are some things that are important about mapping out your book funnel?
You want to understand exactly where the book fits in your marketing plan, and you want to understand how people are going to find it. So for instance, we work with some course creators and they have a course. Well, a course shares information at a certain level and a book shares it at a different level. And so you can map out this funnel to understand, all right, my course participants are going to be buyers of the book, but we also want to make sure that the book readers understand there's a course. So where do these things fit together? Your book funnel. So we have one of the things that I'm going to be offering later, one of the free gifts is a workbook. As an upsell to that, there's a full guide. The workbook gives you all of the questions that you can work through on your own, but the guide, should one choose to purchase it, includes all of the explanations as to how these questions come into play when you're making decisions about your book and your business. So you want to think about what the book itself is and what you can offer in relation to it that will eventually work towards somebody working directly with you or participating in one of your programs or signing up for one of your other products. And you want to make sure that you leave those little Easter eggs in the book to direct people to the things that they're most interested in.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. So what are a few ways that you can effectively use your book as part of your marketing plan? Because I've been waiting to ask this question, right? I'm in marketing. So like when you're talking about marketing plan, what are some ways that you can use your book in that marketing plan?
Once again, with your marketing plan, first of all, you have to think about how people are discovering you, right? Having a book gives one more point of discovery. So you have your website, you have your magazine, you have your podcast. A book can become another way of people being introduced to you. Keeping in mind that Amazon is a huge search engine. When people have problems, they go to YouTube, they go to Google, they go to Amazon. Those are the places they're typically looking for answers. And so you want to make sure that you're discoverable in each of those places. And without a book, you're missing out on a huge discovery opportunity. So think about how that fits in there. And then you also want to think about how it fits in relation to your competitors. And so the competitors who are writing about the same information, you want to make sure that you understand what their strengths and weaknesses are compared to your strengths and weaknesses so that you are differentiating yourself from those other books there. When you have it as part of your marketing plan, obviously, as I said before, you want to figure out where you are sending them from the book, because what you don't want to have happen is you don't want the relationship to end when the covers close. You want them to reach out to you in some way and either sign up for your mailing list, purchase one of your services, get one of your other products, hire you to come speak. You want to think about what different opportunities you can include in the book that will lead into other parts of your business. And so you have to think through your marketing plan in terms of what makes sense to include in the book. And what can I realistically do without the book just becoming a marketing piece? You want the book to have value and substance of its own, because to me, the worst thing you can do is have a book that's a glorified business card. A business card is all about you, right? The business card has your name, your information, what you do, and it's nothing about the person you're handing a business card to. A book should never be a glorified business card. Instead, it should be about the other person. This is what you're trying to solve. These are the answers to how to do it. And oh, by the way, if you want help doing it, reach out to me.
I love that so much. And I have to tell you, Tara, this has been phenomenal. I may even have to say that on this topic, this must be probably the best conversation I've ever had with someone about this. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
I know people are going to want to connect with you. And you did come bearing gifts too, and we'll get to that in a second. But first, how can they connect with you? Because I know they're going to want to.
So the best way to connect with me is our website. It's emeraldlakebooks.com.
That's nice and easy. Okay. And we will also have that in the show notes. But now let's talk about those gifts, because I have to tell you, you came not only just bearing one, but you really came bearing two. And I really love that. So Why don't you tell us a little bit about them? We'll actually put those links in the show notes as well.
Sure. The first one you'll actually find right on the homepage of our website. It is a publishing model quiz. So many people, when they're thinking about writing a book, they really don't understand what's the best way to publish it. And there are pros and cons to traditional publishing and self-publishing and this middle ground that is often referred to as hybrid publishing. And so this 12-question quiz will ask you questions related to you and your content and tell you which publishing model is going to suit you best. And it gives you the next steps to take if you're going to pursue that publishing model. So that's the first gift.
I love those. I love quizzes so much.
They're a lot of fun. The next thing is a reference workbook that we have that is called 61 Questions to Ask Before Choosing a Publisher. And this is going to just give you a list of things that allow you to compare apples to apples when you're talking to either hybrid publishers or traditional publishers about working on your book. Because what we found is a lot of times somebody will come and talk to us, but they have no idea what they should be asking. And so we have to help them along by providing them the information. And because we're very ethical that way, we think that's important that they be informed. We do. But there are other, vanity presses out there, for instance, that, they just want your money. So they're not going to tell you things. So if you don't ask the questions, you can end up in a contract with somebody that doesn't have your best interest in mind. And so these 61 questions will really help you work through the process of understanding what you're getting into before you choose a publisher.
And I think that's really important too. And I really agree with you. I think a lot of times people say, well, I just didn't get the answers I wanted. But we both know that if you ask better questions, you get better answers. And sometimes it is just that you didn't know what questions to ask. And so that is truly valuable. So thank you so much for that.
You're welcome.
So this is the part of the show that I love to call open mic. It's kind of my idea of social karaoke, where I turn the mic over to our guests and ask them to share their number one strategy in the space of marketing, media, money. This is the Marketing, Media, Money podcast. So we want to know your number one strategy. And I'm going to have to tell you, Tara, you're going to have to dig deep here because you have given us so much value and so much information. I'm really glad I let you know that we were going to ask you this question. So what would you say is your number one marketing, media, money strategy?
I think my number one media, marketing, and money strategy is leveraging other people's audiences. It's the fastest way to grow your business and find new clients. And so we do this by forming partnerships with people who have the audience that we're hoping to connect with, who are in ancillary or related services. So we're not competing for the same audience. We're actually providing more benefit and value to the audience that they have. And so that to me is always a win-win for everybody. So that's my number one suggestion.
And it's a great one too, something that I talk about all the time. So I love that. Thank you so much, Tara, for being here with me today. I mean, you really just were so generous in sharing your brilliance and I appreciate it so much.
I've appreciated being here. Thank you for having me, Patty. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. And to the audience, thank you for joining us on the Marketing, Media, Money podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, and I'm sure you did, please like, subscribe, and review the podcast on your favorite listening platform. So important to me that people have takeaways. I love to hear about those takeaways. My inbox is always open. Please let me know what was the thing that really made a change in your business. We really do want to know. So for today, make it a phenomenal day. And remember, if it's not phenomenal, you have the power to change it.
Thank you for joining us today on the Marketing, Media, and Money podcast. To shorten your learning curve even more, make sure to grab your free copy of the Marketing, Media, and Money magazine at www.marketingmediamoney.com. I promise your business will thank you.